At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it, believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of the notorious B-I-G-O-T to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're taking another look at this week is the slippery slope fallacy. And can I just congratulate you on notorious B-I-G-O-T? Lovely. Very good. It was right there waiting.
Yeah.
We'd never spotted it before.
No, it's perfect. Amazing. But there you go. So, yes, we're taking another look at the slippery slope fallacy. This is one we did, I think, episode 10-ish.
Oh, wow.
It's one of the very early ones, obviously. Yeah. In case you're not sure what the slippery slope fallacy is, after all this time, I'm sure that you've gone back and listened to our back catalogue on a regular basis. But if you haven't, this is when someone is usually arguing against a change that someone wants to make. And the argument they make is that if this change happens, inevitable further changes will follow that will take us to a place where no one will be happy.
Particularly not the original proposer.
Yes, absolutely. So even though the first step might be a small one and the change might not have a significant impact, or even if it does have a significant impact, the idea is that those changes are just inevitable. And the reality is that they usually aren't. The reality is that only one change is being sought at the moment. And even if somewhere down the line, some further similar changes might then be sought, those can be dealt with on an ad hoc basis as and when they arise. And in many cases, no further changes are being talked about at this time or will be sought in the future and certainly aren't inevitable.
And particularly in the world of government and politicians, the changes would have to go through legislative procedures, due process.
Yes. You know,
of course, in the current Trump administration, there are... you know, they would just go, oh, well, this means you said we could do that. So that means we could do this, 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 and this as well, because that's, they follow logically. So they're kind of, they're selling you on the slippery slope is built into, if you pass this one, then we can legitimately pass all the other ones.
Yeah, where does it all end?
Where does
the question?
Where will it all end?
That you'll often hear. And the answer to that is usually with this thing that is being proposed right now. That's
just
usually the end
one.
Of what people want.
Yes,
so
exactly.
Our first example from Trump is when he's talking about the immigration plans of Biden, which for the most part are just having a reasonably strong border and not doing illegal stuff to people.
The Biden border bill would turbocharge the continued invasion of our country, and therefore his plan would totally demolish Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, health care, and all of public education.
The fact that he says it would turbocharge the continued invasion, so he's just going, oh yeah, well there's an invasion going on, we'll just take that as read, but it's going to turbocharge that, and then it's going to have an impact on Medicaid and Medicare and the education system. Ironically, all of the things that Trump is doing, despite the fact that he says he's closed the border.
Oh yeah, he said the other day there's been zero illegal border crossings in the last 3 months.
Right.
Which
yet he's dismantling Medicaid and Medicare and the education system.
Yeah. Obviously, there's issues with this argument, not least being that the undocumented people that he's mostly talking about here pay into the social safety net by paying taxes, but don't get any benefits from that. So, whereas you might charitably say that there is an argument that if you have more people in the country, then that is going to put a strain on social systems. That falls down when a large number of those people, especially the people that you are complaining about, are ineligible increasing the funds available for those systems and not taking anything out of them.
And even the legal ones, the people, immigrants that come in legally, they are going to be paying into the system.
Absolutely.
That then they would benefit from. So if they weren't here, they wouldn't be paying in and they wouldn't have an impact. They are here, so they pay their equal share.
Yeah, yeah.
It just,
this
it
is
doesn't...
where you have that dual problem on the right of immigrants are simultaneously sponging off the state and taking our gerbs.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing. It's obviously not inevitable that if there is increased immigration, legal or illegal, that it would cause the complete destruction of all those systems. So the second example from Trump is just talking about the Democrats' approaches to the Second Amendment.
We are very strong in our Second Amendment. The Democrats are not strong at all in the Second Amendment. I would say they're weak on the Second Amendment, and we have to be careful of that. The Democrats would, I believe, I think they'd give up the Second Amendment. And the people that, a lot of the people that put me where I am are strong believers in the Second Amendment, and I am also. And we have to be very careful about that. You know, they call it the slippery slope. And all of a sudden, everything gets taken away. We're not going to let that happen.
It is still on that. They want to abolish our Second Amendment. They're not very strong on it. In fact, I would call them weak.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And if anything, the slope is happening in his rhetoric there. It's they've gone from not being strong on the Second Amendment to being weak on the Second Amendment to taking the Second Amendment away to you losing everything.
Yeah. It's that kind of it's a combination of accelerated truth, so which is going up in my mind. Accelerated truth, you know, kind of increases on a upward trajectory, and a slippery slope goes down on a downwards trajectory. So there they are at the same time. He's accelerating the truth and going down his own slippery slope, revealing his more of his cognitive decline. Even in his limited vocabulary, he can't get his mouth around some of the words.
So our final example in this section is actually from the Dinesh D'Souza film Police State. And this is Dan Bongino on the inevitable outcome of COVID measures.
What was wonderful during COVID? The vaccine? Don't you ask any questions. You got it? And put your mask on and shut up. What do they have in common? They both involve sovereignty over your own body. Because once you can break down the idea that you own your own body, you don't own your money, you don't own your kids, you don't own your health. The body, you have nothing else.
Wow. What? Yeah, sovereignty over your own body. So, yeah, making decisions on the part of other people about the body is the anti-abortion people. Generally on the right,
aren't
they?
You have to completely ignore the hypocrisy involved as well. But just looking at the idea. I mean, there's multiple ideas in there. Well, one being that the thing that masks and vaccines have in common is sovereignty over your own body. Not they are health measures that help stem the tide of a global pandemic. That's the main thing they have in common. But are about taking away sovereignty of your body.
Yeah.
And if you don't own your body, then you don't own your kids.
Yeah,
or anything. You don't own anything. You can't have any belongings. Basically, that's it. Everything gets taken away from you. Because that's the inevitable consequence of making you wear a small cloth mask.
Yeah.
Is that they will take your kids away. You won't have any belongings. That's it. You can't own anything. Because everyone thinks of their kids as their personal possessions, don't they? And you will not be able to have any possessions like children.
Yeah. And this man is now second in command of the FBI.
Yeah. Yeah. He's now co-deputy director of the FBI, because he was doing such an incredibly poor job, they've brought someone else in to co-deputy direct with him.
Wow. And is Kash Patel still...
He's director. He's director of the FBI.
I know. Yeah.
He's in charge, amazingly. What? He looks very surprised by it as well.
Yeah, constantly horrified by the impact of having to lie about things to MAGA, of which he was so recently a part.
And Now is the time, I think, for Mark's British Politics Corner.
So, our go-to conspiracy theorist, no, slippery slope, but yeah, conspiracy theorist and slippery slope. Nigel Farage, obviously, will make an appearance in a moment. But here's Kemi Badenoch, who beginning to conduct the culture wars against history in response to a question from Philip Hollowbone, who's the Conservative MP for Kettering, and this was in December 2023, before she was the leader.
A Museum of London report bizarrely concluded that black people were more likely to die of medieval plague. Will the Minister for Women and Equalities ensure that such sensationalist research findings and woke archaeology have no impact at all on current health and pandemic policy?
Mr. Speaker, I do agree. It was, I'm not even sure whether we can call it just sensationalist or woke. The research apparently was based on phrenology, a completely discredited type of science. And I do agree with him that this type of research is damaging. It's damaging to trust, to social cohesion, to health and trust in health services even. And I've written to the director of the Museum of London expressing my concern.
So the slippery slope there is, we'll come back to woke archaeology in a moment, but the slippery slope is that this kind of report, this kind of divisive rhetoric, which Philip Hollowbone described it as a bizarre discovery, that people of African origin dying were more likely to be dying of the plague, 600 years ago this is, of course, in London, than non-African heritage Londoners. The slippery slope is this kind of divisive rhetoric will dismantle social cohesion and trust in the NHS 600 years later. She also dismissed it as this was based on phrenology. It wasn't. Phrenology is the debunked kind of Victorian semi-psychological idea that the bumps on your head would determine whether you were like going to be a criminal or whether you were going to be smart. But it wasn't based on that at all. They did look at fragments of the features of the skulls that they found in order to determine what their ethnic heritage was.
Yeah, for 600-year-old skeletons, that's one of the ways of determining what someone's heritage was, where in the world they came from.
Yes, exactly. So it's not relying on phrenology. And then to just do a report to say, okay, of the sample that we surveyed, of the skeletons that we found, a large majority of them were of African heritage. They weren't European. And they are more likely, therefore, to be in reduced circumstances, given the social makeup of London at the time. And, you know, slavery and all that was, kind of there. So they would have been in the lower economic echelons of London and therefore would have been affected more gravely by the effects of the plague than people of European heritage, just because of where they would be in the social standing.
That, which is a completely reasonable finding. And calling it woke archaeology, that is... obviously we've talked again and again, and I will later on about the overuse of woke, but this, the only way this could possibly be described as woke is because of the findings, the outcome. They weren't going in and going, right, let's look at
let's nail them on this. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, they were finding out information, which is what you have to do. There's the point of doing the science. They found out that people were disadvantaged if they were from a particular race or background and reported that finding. Yeah. The only way you could avoid being what they consider woke is just not reporting your findings in
not
this
reporting
case.
It. Or not making any recommendations to say this was true then, it may well be true now, that people in reduced circumstances because of their race or heritage or economic status are more likely to be affected by pandemics than those who aren't.
Yeah, but we absolutely know that.
Yeah.
That's the first thing when you said, you know, that this she'll make sure that this doesn't have any impact on current health policy. Why would it? The fact we know right now that minorities have worse health outcomes than white people in the UK in the health service. doesn't have any impact on current health policy.
Yeah.
Why would the fact that was also true 600 years ago and have any impact whatsoever?
And the fact that Philip Hollobone said, will she ensure that these findings have no impact on current health policy, which kind of says we're going to continue to provide health on the basis that some people will be worse off than other people.
Can you ensure
that that continues?
Jesus Christ.
So whilst we're on the impacts of the health system, in August 2024, Keir Starmer looked at banning smoking in public places. And I think he kind of does a bit of a slippery slope, but it's a kind of legitimate one. It talks about preventable deaths and the impact on the NHS and the taxpayers and so forth.
Over 80,000 people lose their lives every year because of smoking. That's a preventable death. It's a huge burden on the NHS. And, of course, it's a burden on the taxpayer. So, yes, we are going to take decisions in this space. More details will be revealed, but this is a preventable series of deaths, and we've got to take the action to reduce the burden on the NHS and reduce the burden on the taxpayer.
This is what I do every day. And the Prime Minister wants to criminalise me. And the danger of it is that they did this in Australia. They made smoking almost impossible. They tax cigarettes to the extent where they're now £35 a packet. So the criminal gangs now don't bother with cocaine. Forget that. Cocaine's boring. Cigarettes are very exciting. And so they run the whole tobacco industry. So if you take a legal activity and you effectively criminalise it, you hand it into the hands of the bad guys. I wonder whether the Labour Party have thought that through. Frankly, thought anything through it. I bet they have.
Now, there we go. So there's Starmer legitimately pointing out that there's 800,000 preventable deaths a year through smoking. Yeah. There's an impact on the NHS. I would have thought it's quite minimal if they're dead. But anyway, there's an impact on the NHS in the treatment of those 800,000.
I'd say there's an impact on the NHS in the treatment of the ones who aren't yet dead.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. The deaths aren't the only ones affected. It obviously has a significantly negative impact on people's health, and that has an impact on the NHS. This isn't a slippery slope in any way. This is honestly talking about the direct consequences of the fact that people smoke.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, frog-faced fascist Nigel Farage says, actually, if you criminalise this, it happened in Australia, and they made it virtually impossible to smoke by charging $35 a packet. But I suspect people are still buying them. It's not impossible. You just have to spend $35. But then what happened was that the drug dealers, who no longer interested in dealing with cocaine because you can make more money dealing with cigarettes, so it's now a criminal gang. So they're handing it literally into the hands of the bad guys. So if you try and prevent 800,000 deaths, what you're doing is worse than giving license to cocaine dealers.
I think whether this is a slippery slope depends partly on to what extent that's true, what he's saying about Australia.
Right.
Because if we take him at absolute face value, which is hard to do with Farage, and believe that is the impact of the high cigarette tax in Australia, because they do have one of the highest tobacco taxes in the world, I'm sure it has increased the black market because that makes sense. But I don't know if it means that drug dealers have moved away from cocaine and onto cigarettes and it has caused increased crime. In fact, if the drug dealers have moved away from cocaine and onto cigarettes, that might not be an entirely bad thing. Because cigarettes, bad as they are, probably aren't as bad as cocaine. If drug dealers are moving directly over from cocaine to tobacco, that might not be that big an issue. If it's increasing crime generally, increasing gang activity or, mob activity or whatever from people getting into that business because it is now an attractive black market business to be in, that might be a direct consequence of excessive taxation. That said, where I would say it is a slippery slope is that the assumption that if we ban smoking in public places, then we are also inevitably going to increase the taxes on cigarettes to a point where crime is going to increase is, that's a slippery slope because that's not an inevitable consequence at all of banning smoking in public places.
Right. So if somebody calls out an argument as a slippery slope, as often they do as a shortcut in order to dismiss somebody pointing out consequences, then you can counter it by saying, well, actually, each of those are verifiably true, and they have been seen to be the consequences elsewhere.
Yes. If the consequences are at least likely, then still saying they're inevitable isn't true or fair, but making the argument that this is a likely or possible thing that could happen and that's something we should worry about when deciding whether to take this first step is reasonable. So, it's a slippery slope still if someone is saying this will definitely happen if we take this step, we must not take this step. But asking people to consider that is a possible consequence when deciding what route to go down. And yeah, in this case, I think the biggest difference comes from banning, because he moves away from banning smoking in public places to taxation, which are two completely separate ways of dealing with this public health issue. And Starmer was talking about banning smoking in public places. Taxation is another way that governments, including our government, deals with it. And in fact, in terms of it, like the exchange rate at the moment, the average price, I just looked it up, the average price of a pack of cigarettes in the UK is approximately £16.48, which in Australia would be, I think, roughly $30.
Oh, wow.
Maybe a bit less than $30 US dollars. So it's not necessarily that far off. So if that taxation in Australia has led directly to an increase in crime, if we were talking about increasing the tax on cigarettes, then maybe that would be a reasonable argument on whether that would be a good or useful thing to do or not, because it would be one of the outcomes that you would consider before making that decision.
Yeah. He also, he actually says that the amount of tax that smokers pay pretty much makes them the heroes of the NHS. And also he gets asked by the interviewer, well, if you've done this every day for 30 years, aren't you worried about your own health? And he kind of dismisses that as his own private choice. And I suspect his impact on the NHS will be somewhat ameliorated by his private health cover, the one that he had that put him back to full health when he crashed the gyrocopter. Yeah, just when you want those long NHS waiting lists, where are those when we need them? And the final example is an echo of the migration slippery slope. This is Kemi Badenoch in November 2024, when she was newly elected leader of the Tory party, spelling out the slippery slope of the consequences of allowing people fleeing cruel regimes elsewhere in the world to seek asylum in our currently cruelty-free country.
We need to talk about immigration. The truth is that for nearly 30 years, mass migration has been far, far too high under all governments, by all parties, and not just here, too high all across the Western world. If immigration happens too quickly, there is no integration. The ties that bind us start to fray. It doesn't matter whether you are massively for immigration or massively against, without a shared national identity, our country will suffer. We can all see the pressure on housing, roads, GPs, and wages. It's nonsense that we have allowed a situation where judges deem perfectly safe countries to be unsafe, that loopholes are willfully exploited by those coming here. Our institutions are failing. They've proven they are unable to determine who wants to contribute and who is simply exploiting our openness. Britain is a high trust society, but we can't let our system be taken advantage of. It's time to tell the truth on immigration. And over the coming months, that's exactly what I'm going to do.
In what way is Britain a high trust society?
Exactly.
Who do we trust?
There's no written constitution. So the idea is that you trust the judiciary. So that's part of her slippery slope, is we've got all this immigration and it's eroding not only the roads and the GPs and wages, but it's eroding the judiciary itself. And she's conflating several things in there. So she talks about, actually, there is a truth about mass migration has increased across the Western world. And up on in the video, you get USA, Poland, France, Italy. Yes, mass migration has increased, but she glosses over the causes of that, which is basically war and the funding and arming of wars by successive British governments and governments across the world. There is a problem of mass migration. This isn't the solution. This this isn't the problem. The problem is people going to war and people funding wars and people fleeing war zones and seeking asylum elsewhere. And if we're a high trust society, why wouldn't you want to come and stay here? But no, there's an impact on the roads. There's an impact on the roads. What the fuck? It's the same argument again, that about 80% of asylum seekers get granted asylum. The issue has been that the asylum granting process or the asylum reviewing process was deliberately held up by the likes of Priti Patel and Suella Braverman and Robert Jemrick in order to foment a crisis. The problem isn't the immigration. So she's conflated mass migration, with impacts on social provisions, and then about the justice system, which is just upholding the law in trying to process the asylum requests. And she's saying, oh, they're not doing the right thing. But the problem the Tories have got and the problem that we've all got is that they fucked up their last administration so much that nobody trusts them. And this lets Farage in the side door, who can, because he's been an outsider all the time, he can point to the other politicians, even though he's a fucking career politician, he can point to all the other politicians and saying, they aren't doing it right. Let me in and I'll do it right. Badenoch's got the problem of saying, we did it wrong, let us back in and we'll do it right. And they're employing, as we saw them do and we're seeing Starmer do, employing the rhetoric of the far-right fascist Farage, who could happily spout all of these things knowing he'd never have to be in power to do it, and knowing that the political climate wasn't such that it would be acceptable, but now it is, and it's of the Tories' own making. So they're having a go at immigrants, impacts on social provision and the judiciary, and conflating all of them as a kind of slippery slope thing, saying if we don't do anything about this, then the judiciary will start falling apart. Basically, they want to, you know, take us out of the European Court of Human Rights, so you can't appeal to, and they want to reinstate Rwanda, so those abuse of human rights. All of that stuff.
Yeah, because it's ridiculous that judges are able to say that Rwanda's not safe.
Yes, yes, because Rwanda, the government said it's a safe country. They just said it.
They didn't used to say it was a safe country. They changed it, didn't they?
When the fucking genocide was going on, they were a little bit against that, and now they've changed their mind when it required Priti Patel to go and stand there grinning when she was overseeing the provision that the people provide in the internment camps. So it's ridiculous that the judiciary could just say, where they've come from is at war, it's not safe. If they go back, they will be killed. But whereas a government could say, that country we thought was terrible, actually, no, it's great, it's safe. Look, we've passed a bill of parliament to say the country is safe. Just saying it doesn't make it so.
Slip slide in a way, you know your need for justification just means you slip slide in a way. I know a man, pretends he's from my hometown. He wears his passion for all power like a thorny crown. Said voters, I live in fear. My need for you so desperate, 'cause otherwise I will disappear. Slip slide in a way, slip slide in a way. You know your need for justification just needs to slip slide in a way. Slip sliding away, slip sliding away. You know your need for justification is just a wild fallacy.
Paul Simon there, of course, with Slip Sliding Away.
And in The Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective. And our first example this week is from the film Winter, Spring, Summer and Fall, which stars the brilliant Jenna Ortega.
Yeah.
In this case, as a high school student, I guess like an 18-year-old, 17, 18-year-old, who is kind of on her way to Harvard, but in the spring of her senior year, she gets into a relationship and decides that actually she wants to defer Harvard for a year and go to Costa Rica and save turtles with her boyfriend. And her parents aren't happy about that for some reason.
It's already decided. I'm going.
I mean, first, it's Costa Rica, right? Then it's Australia. And then the next thing you know, you're getting arrested for muling in a Bangkok airport and spending life in a Thai prison.
Uh-huh. That's it, yeah. First it's saving turtles, and then you're going to be muling in Bangkok and end up in a Thai prison.
Yeah, you spend life in a Thai prison. It is presented as, yeah, this is obviously what's going to happen. If you go to Costa Rica for the summer instead of going to Harvard, you'll obviously, inevitably end up going to Australia and then to Bangkok and end up in a Thai prison for the rest of your life.
It's kind of ironic because that's the kind of, it's the inevitable gap year, isn't it, for graduates from high school here before they go off to university, will go off on a gap year, and they will do. That's the English version of that. Yeah, don't do that. Because you'll go there, you'll think you'll do lots of stuff. You'll end up wearing beads and those ridiculous baggy trousers that Jacob Collier seems to wear, and people will think you're a wanker. There's the slippery slope.
Now, that's an inevitable consequence.
Yeah, well, it's just the truth. Yeah. Yeah, verifiably true.
So our second example comes from Dawson's Creek. This clip features the excellent Michelle Williams as Jen, this is the final season of Dawson's Creek, and so they're at college in Boston, and Grams has come to join her in Boston and is decided to also sign up for some courses, including math, because the man that she is currently seeing teaches math.
Right.
Jen thinks that this is not a great way to go.
Wait a second, math? You told me you actually took my advice.
Stranger things have happened.
And I suppose this has nothing to do with the fact that a certain someone actually teaches math.
Are you implying that there's anything wrong with taking an interest in someone's life's work?
I think it's a slippery slope. I mean, one minute you're taking an interest, and the next you're sublimating your own thoughts and desires, and for what? For a grand chance to participate in the great patriarchal heterosexist fraud that is better known as monogamy? Is that really how you want to spend your golden years? Folding some man's laundry and pretending to actually share an interest in... haven't we come further as a sex?
All from just showing an interest in the...
Just because she's got a math book, she's going to take a math class.
Sublimating all the rights. Yeah, all the rights we've gained since Emily Pankhurst threw herself under the horse. You're going to sublimate yourself to folding his laundry. And have we come that far? You're just going to buy into the patriarchal sexist diatribe. Brilliant.
Whereas, of course, it is possible that she is just going to do a math class, learn a bit about calculus, and then that's fine. Won't actually go any further.
Discover the orange stacking problem. And that's it. Or just fancy this guy. You go, oh, that's quite nice. I'd like to spend some time in a math class with him. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Our final clip in this section this week is from Man on the Inside, featuring the excellent Ted Danson. This is the Michael Schur sitcom about Ted Danson going undercover in a residential home because there have been a series of thefts.
Yeah.
And the kind of head of the residence committee is trying to get something done about it.
Helen's necklace was stolen. Then Elliot's watch. Who knows what else? If crime is not addressed, things can spiral quickly. Personally, I don't want to get mugged in the buffet line or sex trafficked on the dark web.
That seems unlikely.
Going from mugged in the buffet line in the residential home to being sex trafficked on the dark web. That's,
I mean, not
the inevitable consequence.
Getting mugged in the buffet line is already a significant increase from having a watch stolen from a room or something like that. So,
yeah.
It escalates quickly. And as the representative of the residential home there says, yeah, it doesn't seem like that's probably what's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, you got to nip these things in the bud, because otherwise they will inevitably snowball into much bigger crimes.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks.
I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody. As well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for fake news, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
Of course, I'd just like to point out, if I don't win, then it's clear that we won't be able to prevent the next earthquake from creating a tsunami fit to wash away the sands of the Sahara and leave in its wake a green and pleasant floodplain where cats and dogs will end up living together in peace and harmony. You mark my words.
Yeah, full chaos if you don't win. That's inevitable.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah,
the theme this week is he's talking about the Lincoln bedroom in the White House. This will not help you, but the beginning of this paragraph that he starts talking about it was he was talking about the assassination attempt in Butler, Pennsylvania last year. And for some reason he gets distracted by describing the first time he was in the White House and saw the Lincoln bedroom, and goes off on that tangent, goes off on several other tangents while talking about the Lincoln bedroom. And I think he gets back eventually to how it ties into the assassination attempt.
Well, that's the weave. It's the weave. Yeah.
So here are some of the tangents that he talked about during that.
Okay.
Statement number one.
Mm-hmm.
When I got to the White House, I was standing right outside and then inside the Lincoln bedroom, the bedroom of Abraham Lincoln, his wife, his son, Tad, who died actually as a very young boy, very young. It was a very rough time for them. They were suffering tremendous melancholia. You know, they called it melancholia, not depression. It's the same thing, but in those days they called it melancholia. But I was in the Lincoln bedroom, so famous. All the furniture, just the way it is.
Wow. Wow. Melancholia, okay. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And his son, Tad, yeah.
Statement number two.
Right.
And if you've seen it, a lot of people have seen it. Some people have seen it very strongly, if you know what I mean. Some people have spent a lot of time there, I'll just say that. But if you've seen pictures, it's not on the tour. Maybe it is on the tour. I never took the tour because I was never in Washington. I was in Washington maybe 17 times. I'm not really a Washington person. I'm a New York person. So I never really was in Washington. So the first time I was there was when I got elected. And it's Abraham Lincoln's bedroom.
Excellent. Right. Yeah. Yeah. If you've seen them, it's not on the tour. Maybe it is. Right. Yeah. I didn't do it. It might be.
And statement number three.
Yeah.
And he was very tall. He was 6'6". That's like the equivalent of a Baron Trump today, who's a lot taller than 6'6". He's a good-looking guy, but he is tall. But he was 6'6". In those days, very unusual, but he was tall. And then you put his hat on, which was another foot, right? So he was a pretty tall guy. But the bed was very long. You could see it was elongated. But I was there, and it was like a really surreal... I was with the First Lady, who was very popular, who got the number one book in the country. Can you believe it? Go buy it. Go buy that book.
Wow. I thought it was because I was with the First Lady, who's also very tall. But no, she's very popular.
Yeah, still some way off a point to this story.
Well, he's gone assassination, Lincoln, tall man, big hat. Yeah. All of those kind of things that you say when you're an old geezer watching a movie. You go, yeah, he's very tall. What's he been in? Okay, so, well, until you did number three, I was thinking number two was probably fake because there's, well, here's my thing, because number one has got rough time and tremendous melancholia. Or have you just spotted last time and repeated one of the words, which he did last time, and it would turn out to be the real one? Or is number two the amalgam of old stuff about how many times I've been in Washington, and then the Baron Trump thing happens, and you think, that would be good to hear that. How did he get from, he was tall, and there's another hat, and the bed is there, and she's got a book. That might even be beyond the bounds of a gym. Okay, on the just going with the Washington 17 times thing, so I think number two is the one that you made up.
Okay, So of the other two, which are you more convinced by?
I think I'm more convinced by The Tremendous Melancholia, so number one.
Okay. And number one?
Yeah.
Is real.
When I got to the White House, I was standing right outside and then inside the Lincoln bedroom, the bedroom of Abraham Lincoln, his wife, his son, Tad, who died, actually, as a very young boy, very young. It was a very rough time for them. They were suffering tremendous melancholia. You know, they called it, they were melancholy. Melancholia, they called it, not depression. It's the same thing, but in those days, they call it melancholia. But I was in the Lincoln bedroom, so famous, all the furniture just the way it is.
Yeah, melancholia. That's his word of the day.
And it's just, he needs to explain everything. Either is he amazed that he's remembered these facts? Because he hasn't read them. Somehow,
I mean,
it's like he's read the information, you know, thing outside, that, or he's spoken to a docent outside the thing who's told him this stuff. Yeah, well, why do, so he caveats everything he said. I was standing outside and then inside.
And then inside. Yeah, because that's how rooms work.
Yeah, exactly. And then he explains the Lincoln bedroom is the bedroom of Abraham Lincoln rather than, say, a Lincoln Continental convertible from the 70s.
Well, yeah. And then here's the thing. Yeah.
Right.
Because you say he's proud that he's remembered these facts. And it does seem like some of them are obvious, like the Lincoln bedroom, the bedroom of Abraham Lincoln. He's wrong about almost all of the things he says. Yeah. Abraham Lincoln did suffer from depression, which they did call melancholia. His son, Tad, outlived Abraham Lincoln. He died like 18, but that was after Abe died. So they did have two other sons who died young, but not Tad.
Right.
So that was wrong.
Right.
Also, the Lincoln bedroom in the White House was not Abraham Lincoln's bedroom.
Oh, my God.
It is a bedroom.
It wasn't.
Named for Abraham Lincoln, but it was Lincoln's cabinet office. He never slept there. It has a bed in it now, which people use sometimes. Yeah, yeah. Was used by several presidents, but it was not Lincoln's bedroom. He's wrong about...
Brilliant. I wonder if there's
like the facts that he said. He did have a wife.
Fantastic.
He did have a son called Tad. Those two bits were basically it.
And he did have melancholia. Yeah. But nothing else is true. Yeah.
You also think that number three is real.
Yeah.
And number three is real.
And he was very tall. He was 6'6". That's like the equivalent of a Baron Trump today. You know? Who's a lot taller than 6'6"? He's a good-looking guy, but he is tall. And but he was 6'6". In those days, very unusual, but he was tall. And then you put his hat on, which was another foot, right? So he was a pretty tall guy. But the bed was very long. You could see it was elongated. But I was there, and it was like a really surreal. I was with the First Lady, who was very popular, who got the number one book in the country. Can you believe it? Paul Miranda, go buy it. Go buy that book.
Man, that's like, he needs to explain what 6'6" looks like.
Yeah.
So that's, it's a tall, and of course, it's got to be a Trump-based person. I had suddenly had a vision there of that. Remember that woman comedian on TikTok or wherever it was, who would mime to his speeches?
It would
look ridiculous because it was, I just saw her doing this one. So given that the bed in the Lincoln bedroom isn't Lincoln's bed.
Wasn't his bed. He never slept in it. Nothing to do with.
No.
It is a long bed. I think it's called the Rosewood bed, but it is 8 foot long, but it wasn't Lincoln's bed. And like, it wouldn't need to be extra long because he also had a hat. He also, while we're doing fact checking, wasn't 6 foot six.
Wasn't 6 foot six.
He was 6 foot four. And someone in the past being 6 foot six isn't the equivalent of someone who is now taller than 6 foot six. That's not how equivalents work.
No.
Baron Trump is, depending on who you ask, somewhere between 6'7" and 6'9", which is very tall.
Yeah.
But that isn't...
But 6 foot six is like the equivalent. It's like the dollar equivalent of, you know, a Hershey bar in...
it's not inflation.
Yeah, it's not inflation. Well, that's like... Well, he thinks inflation about Tic Tac boxes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, mind you, and he can reduce prices by 12,000%. So, you know, that's where right. you end up, the shop ends up paying you. So
you got that right. The Washington being in Washington 17 times was indeed one I made up.
That was the tell. Wow.
I mean, nice. It is one of those ones where basically I always randomly assign which one is going to be the fake news of one, two, or three.
Yeah.
I rolled a dice and it chose number two as being the fake one. So I had to fill space between him talking about the furniture in the Lincoln bedroom and how tall Lincoln was.
Right.
And that's what I came up with.
The tour bit was very, very Trumpian. It's not on the tour. Mm. Maybe it is on the tour. I never took the tour because I've never even watched it. Yeah, it was something about it was the Washington in 17 times. Because I'm thinking, hello, I know that from before.
Part of what is making this increasingly difficult over the 8 years we've been doing this.
Millennia.
Because he's got a vocabulary of like 150 words. They can only go together in so many different combinations. It is becoming hard to say things he might say that he hasn't said. Because he keeps saying the same things over and over again. I will say that Trump's obvious cognitive decline is a boon for me in this game, because it does mean I'm able to put things together that other people wouldn't necessarily say.
Right.
So we do have some social contestants on Patreon. Richard Thunder Hopkins says, I don't have my glasses, so I'm just hoping I can get a shout out without reading the options. Fake news is probably number two, though, because he's a massive number two. So yeah, there you go. Sometimes that just works.
Very good, very good.
One-eyed Nick says, well, that's a whole lot of nothing to talk about by the tangerine tit. I honestly couldn't say. I think I remember number one because it's all wrong. Number two is inane bollocks that I can see following on from one.
Mm.
He didn't mention how tall he is in number three. There's no way he'd talk about Barron without mentioning how tall he is too. So I'm saying that three is fake news.
Very good, very good.
Renee Z. Yeah. Says, I can't wait to hear Mark work his way through these. I'm going with my first guess for fake news number two. Number one seems true because of his obsession over melancholia. Number three is tricky, but I think it's true. Even Jim couldn't have made up the pivot to Melania and telling folks to buy her book. Unless Jim thinks the word melancholia may have reminded Trump of Melania and Jim created some great fake news.
Very good.
Invisible Unicorn says number three is just too easy. He'd probably say it, but it's just too easy. And surreal, is that a word in his orange frappe of neurons? He lives in a surreal fog where nothing is not surreal. Three is fake.
Right. Nice. I like your thinking, but you're wrong.
Scott says, wow, just wow. All three consist of the meandering shit sausage of words we've come to expect from Donald's purulent sphincter of a mouth. I would say that number three is fake because I cannot fathom him correctly using the word surreal. So, two going for the surreal as a tell. And on Facebook, Mike Thunder says, I haven't heard him say any of these. Going to say three is fake. Wild guess.
Mm.
And Jeremy says, number one, the other two give a this is a report on a book I haven't read vibe. And he can't remember his own kid's name, so unless he watched the Daniel Day-Lewis movie 15 minutes before that, there's no way he would remember Tad. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Well, he didn't remember that Tad was the one who outlived Abe.
No.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
So it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, is called A Red Carpet for Putin is Not a Logical Fallacy, because Trump met with Vladimir Putin in Alaska. Actually, he said for a while before that he was going to Russia to meet Putin because he forgot that Alaska was in the US. And people didn't seem to think that was weird because he's, you know, in obvious cognitive decline. But he was doing it in Alaska. And obviously, when you're a major world power hosting a war criminal who is currently the aggressor in a major war, you want to treat them with as much deference and respect as you possibly can. So they laid out a literal red carpet on the tarmac for Putin's arrival. It was just as embarrassing as you kind of expected it probably would be.
Yeah.
It was a plus that we came away with him not having actually given Alaska to Putin.
Yeah, because that's because he thought he owned it already, probably. It was so obvious that he's just a big fangirl and he can't get enough of him. He didn't even do the kind of aggressive handshake thing where he grabs him and pulls him in or anything like that, because he's the gang leader of the gang that Trump wants to join. All of Europe flew out to America and said, right, thank God Trump's meeting him. Okay, don't sell Ukraine down the river. Here's what you need to say. So like all the grown-ups arrived and he said, yeah, great, thanks for coming. And then said some inane shit and everybody just went, oh, fuck, you know, it's all going to be awful. And he didn't hold Putin's feet to the fire at all.
Not the slightest. I mean,
not at all.
He said going in that, because this obviously was part of the ongoing negotiations that are designed to end the Russia-Ukraine war.
Yeah.
So he said going in that what he was requiring out of this was a ceasefire. And if there wasn't a ceasefire, there would be consequences for Russia to pay.
Yeah.
Because if they basically couldn't get them to come to that agreement. And he'd already blown past the deadline for imposing sanctions on Russia and not imposed any.
Yeah.
The prior argument that he might increase the tariffs on Russia were, in fact, he hasn't even done that. But if he did do that, it wouldn't really make much of a difference because there's basically no trade between Russia and the US at the moment anyway because of the sanctions that have previously been placed on Russia. So it wouldn't really have had any impact on the Russian economy. But yeah, he did say going in that the goal of this meeting was to get a ceasefire and he wouldn't be happy if they didn't get a ceasefire and there would be consequences. And he came out having said, basically, they didn't really talk about a ceasefire. The plan is to move straight to a peace agreement, i.e. bypass the ceasefire.
Yeah.
But the peace agreement isn't actually in play. Any further negotiations about it are down the line. And this is just kind of... There's nothing been agreed. They gave a joint press conference, kind of. Although it looked very much like Putin's press conference that he'd invited Donald to Putin tag along press to.
And he wasn't and didn't really expect him to speak. So Putin would kind of do all this stuff and then Trump would back up all of the talking points.
Yeah.
And that's what Putin seems to have the expectation of. And just even though he's, you know, shorter than Trump by half a head, Trump believes so much in wearing the risers in his shoes and being the taller man and all that stuff, but he just kind of cowered into insignificance. It was embarrassing to see.
Yeah. Putin spoke first at the press conference and welcomed Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Again, Alaska's still American, so it really should have been Trump in charge, but no, he's not able to assert any kind of dominance over someone like Putin. They didn't take any questions from the press at all, which there would have been questions because the things they said were basically that the talk that they had went very well and they agreed on some things, but they disagreed on one significant thing. There was one like significant stumbling block, but there was no opportunity for the press to ask, what are the things you agreed on and what was the thing you really didn't agree on that is causing a problem now? But because they didn't take any questions. So they both fucked off.
Yeah.
So basically they had this meeting. We learned nothing at all, except that, I mean, we already knew this. This wasn't a new thing we learned, but that Trump isn't going to do anything whatsoever to increase the likelihood of Putin doing a good thing.
No, because he could have. He could have said, okay, we are going to continue to arm Ukraine, and unless you stop bombing them and killing lots of people, we're going to arm Ukraine even more. Those would be the consequences. And yes, we are going to enact consequences that will really hit. Short of going to war with Russia, Trump's got very little room for manoeuvre, and Putin knows it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. So Trump will say things like, well, Europe is happy to put boots on the ground where we're not, so we might give some air cover, and now he isn't. And he's just...
There's a lot of things that Trump could, if they were actually interested, because he didn't give a shit. But if he was interested in actually having an impact, there's a lot they could do. They could break some of the bilateral ties between Russia and the US. They could say that they will fund and support Ukraine. They could recognize Ukraine and their plan to join NATO.
NATO.
Like if he said that the US would back Ukraine joining NATO, that would be a significant thing that Russia doesn't want.
Mm.
So that would be a way to get concessions. But obviously he's not going to do that because he just doesn't give a shit, because what he wants is Putin to like him. And Putin knows that any slight flattery that he gives Trump will just weigh more into his ego and his thinking than anything he could possibly say about Ukraine. And so Putin agreed with, or kind of, I don't know if he necessarily said it outright, but you know the thing that Trump's been saying about how this would never have happened, you know, they wouldn't have attacked Ukraine what if I was president at the time.
Mm.
And Putin's kind of basically said, yeah, all right, let's go with that. So that kind of gives him another boost. But he's also told Trump that the reason he lost in 2020 was mail-in voting and how bad mail-in ballots are. And that obviously feeds into Trump's ego. The main thing that has come out of this meeting is that Trump then kind of said, oh, Putin says I would have won if it wasn't for the mail-in ballot. So I'm banning mail-in ballots now, despite the fact he doesn't actually have the ability to do that. So he issued an executive order requiring states not to use mail-in ballots, not understanding or not caring, probably both, that the states inherently get to decide how they run their own elections. So, yeah, it was a completely useless summit, as we fully expected going in. I mean...
And it just illustrates that Trump is completely useless.
Putin came away from it, if anything, with just more of a standing on the world stage. He has been given some legitimacy that he shouldn't have had, given that he is a war criminal currently as an aggressor in a war. The US treated him with kid gloves compared to how they treated Zelensky on his visit to the Oval Office, even how they treated Zelensky in his subsequent visit to the White House, when he was treated with a lot more respect than he was last time. But... you know, no red carpet for him, no posh meal planned, as we found out from documents that were left on a hotel printer in Alaska by some other members of Trump's entourage. Jesus Christ, because their security is just so great. Yeah. One of the documents that were just left on a public printer in the hotel, apart from names and phone numbers and addresses and stuff of the various people who were at the meeting, was a lunch menu that they were holding a luncheon in honor of His Excellency Vladimir Putin. So that's great.
Isn't there an international warrant out for Putin's arrest? So the US...
No, they could have arrested him when he stepped off the plane.
Yeah, could have just arrested him, banged him up and said, that's it. Yeah, just fucking stop it or we won't let you out.
Yeah.
We'll shove you in Guantanamo and forget to throw away the key.
I feel like... there might have been some pushback by the Russians if he'd done that. I'm not surprised that didn't happen.
But as it is, he did less than nothing. The BBC reporter Steve Rosenberg, who's the Russian correspondent, voiced the amusement of all the news reporters that came to cover the thing and said, yeah, we've all come a very long way for absolutely nothing. And all it did was Putin... played Trump like a fiddle. He knows exactly how to deal with him, and Trump is just vague and, oh, yeah, well, I'll give it 2 weeks and then I'll do something.
Mm.
Says all the right things to all the right people, and everybody knows that he's not going to follow through on any of them, including Putin, knowing that he's not going to follow through on any kind of sanctions or any kind of slapdown or, oh, yeah, things are going to get tough. They're not, because he's Taco Trump.
A few years ago when he met Putin in Helsinki and he was just so ridiculously deferential and everyone was like, what the fuck is going on? This is the leader of the free world.
Exactly.
The thing is that now that's exactly what we've come to expect. So it's that at the time, it was somehow still a surprise. It was somehow not what was expected, and it was crazy that was what happened. But it's not shocking that he got an F-35 flypast arranged for Putin, or that he let him ride in the presidential limo, or you know, that yeah. he basically treated him like a visiting dignitary, which he shouldn't yeah. do, because it's a war summit. It's a supposed to be yeah. about brokering peace and stopping lots of people from being killed needlessly.
Yeah.
It's yeah. not about buttering him up and showing him a good time.
And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
You probably won't be surprised to hear that we don't have Cracker Barrel in the UK. And on my US trips, I've stayed in big cities, so I don't think I've ever seen one in the wild. But that's not going to stop me weighing in on the latest culture war. In case you're unaware, Cracker Barrel changed their logo to a more minimalist word mark on a vaguely barrel-shaped background from the previous rather busy one featuring an old guy, a barrel, and the word mark on, I don't know, a stomach? What is that? Anyway, right-wingers lost their absolute shit, as is their wont. The removal of the old guy, you see, is woke. Yeah, I'm not sure why either. It's not like they replaced him with a lesbian M&M in comfortable shoes. But he's been there since the 70s, goddammit, and Republicans don't like change because if you change things, you might accidentally benefit people they hate.
Mm-hmm.
This change doesn't benefit anybody, just to be clear. Nobody was calling for the cancellation of Uncle Herschel, the old guy in question. It's not, as far as I can tell, a Confederate general, a slave owner, or a racist caricature like Aunt Jemima. The real guy he's maybe based on was born in Tennessee in 1915, so there's a decent chance he was about as progressive as the average Fox News host. But that's not why he's gone. The fact is that the Cracker Barrel brand was built around vintage Americana and down-home Southern country cooking, and the regulars were exactly the kind of rural Americans who yearn for imaginary simpler times, so they skewed older and more Republican. That same group, who is now promising to boycott the chain because a plain logo hurts their fifis, were already not eating there in large enough numbers post-COVID. Having lost two-thirds of their share price since 2021 and still struggling to make anywhere near their pre-COVID revenue, the company hoped that redecorating and rebranding might make them appeal to younger customers. Probably won't work, but if they go broke, it won't be because they went woke. It'll be because they're just not that relevant anymore.
Ryan Walters, Oklahoma's Superintendent for Public Instruction, is instituting a new assessment for teachers relocating there from, shall we say, more liberal states, New York and California initially, that keeps away woke indoctrinators. We will not allow these leftist plans and schemes to take place here in Oklahoma, Walters told CNN. They're trying to warp the minds of our kids to turn them into social justice warriors. I mean, heaven forbid that should happen, going around ensuring that everyone gets justice in their societies. We got superheroes for that, and we know that they all want to work for ICE these days, so we'll definitely continue to vote Republican. Instead, he continues, they should be turning them into kids that are getting the most of their God-given talents to go get a good job, to go live a fulfilling life. The implication is obviously that fighting for justice will not lead to a fulfilling life, which might explain why Ryan Walters is so unfulfilled and angry. Teachers transferring to Oklahoma must sit an assessment test developed by PragerU, right-wing TV shows host Dennis Prager's company that states PragerU is not an accredited university, nor do we claim to be. We don't offer degrees, but we do provide free educational content that promotes the American values of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all ages. Having a say in who can teach their shit rather than just providing the shit is somewhat of a watershed moment for the company, shifting it from just being an outside organisation that provides materials to now having a say in certifying teachers. Marissa Strait, CEO of PragerU, said that the Oklahoma superintendent asked for a test that is more wholesome and in line with the Oklahoma parent body. You know there's trouble as soon as the word wholesome appears. The test specifically evaluates educators on areas including their understanding of American exceptionalism and their grasp of fundamental biological differences between boys and girls. Of course, on the sensible side of the aisle, John Waldron, the Oklahoma Democratic Party chairman and former social studies teacher, told CNN, "You don't sign up to teach schools because you hate America. That's not who's teaching in our classrooms," and characterized the assessment as a loyalty test from an unaccredited agency, which sounds like the fundamental of Trump land right there. And where better to indoctrinate the young pioneers to reductio ad Hitler youth than in schools? Asked by CNN, who will oversee and make sure that the assessments are being taken and passed, Walters said bluntly, "It's up to me." So he's a qualified educationalist, no doubt. Earlier this year, the Department of Education worked with Prageru to create a new exhibit for the White House, and videos shown a part of it concluded with the disclaimer that the partnership does not constitute or imply U.S. government or U.S. Department of Education endorsement of Prageru. Yeah, right. What did they teach you at school?
Yeah, while we're talking about Ryan Walters, incidentally, I think just for the sake of accuracy, we should note that while we mentioned in a previous episode that he may have shown porn in a meeting with some educators, since come to light that it probably wasn't porn. It was merely full frontal nudity in a Jackie Chan film that was playing on his Samsung TV.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, he did still
so
show
that was far more
full
appropriate.
Frontal nudity
yeah.
to people in a meeting.
Yeah.
But it may not be.
Was an actual porn.
We, you know, may not. We don't know he wasn't whacking off to it, but it, as far as we know, wasn't actual porn. So, there you go. Just wanted to be absolutely
clear. Clearing that up. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of shit gets talked about the Trump administration's approach to diversity, equity and inclusion. But if you actually take the time to listen to Trump officials, you'll see that it's not just racists, misogynists and homophobes hiding behind buzzwords to guarantee safe spaces for mediocre white men who can only function when surrounded entirely by other mediocre white men. It's actually about meritocracy. Take the FBI, for example. Under Biden, so many highly qualified, strong, smart, noble, cishet white men were denied the chance to join America's elite law enforcement agency because they insisted on hiring less qualified gay, black and brown women instead to fill some kind of diversity quota. As everyone knows, that kind of woke bullshit just puts American lives in danger. So under the strong leadership of Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, all the leftist communist FBI agents who did their job that they were hired to do by investigating January 6th have been purged, and another 5,000 unpatriotic employees who didn't fancy working for conspiracist assholes accepted the early retirement offer from DOGE and will leave next month. That leaves plenty of space for the right kind of people. The only trouble is, it turns out there aren't quite as many super capable experienced geniuses who missed out due to DEI as they thought, and the Bureau is now planning to lower the job requirements, for example, eliminating the need for a college degree for agents, thereby allowing the FBI to draw recruits from other federal law enforcement agencies who previously wouldn't have qualified, because that's how meritocracy works. In case you're worried that loosening their standards threatens the FBI's reputation and effectiveness, this shouldn't concern you, because you should reserve that concern for the fact that due to the imminent loss of thousands of agents and the incompetence of their leaders, the new ill-equipped rookies will be fast-tracked to full service after only 8 weeks of training at Quantico instead of the traditional 18.
Wow.
In a parallel abandonment of quality control, dog-murdering DHS Secretary Kristi Noem announced this month that anyone over 18 can now apply to join ICE, removing the previous age limits of 21 to 37 that prevented teenage racists and their middle-aged racist dads from bonding while abducting people from Home Depot parking lots in unmarked vans. Kristi claims that they already have 80,000 applicants for the 10,000 vacancies they're trying to fill. So the fact they're now removing barriers to get more people to apply implies that barely any of those 80,000 meet the minimum requirements of the job, which, as far as I can tell, are a complete lack of shame and the ability to complete an obstacle course quicker than Dean Cain.
I've just thought of the term mediocrity.
Yes. Very good.
Yes. I suppose we could take some comfort from the fact that when Bill Barr, Donald's former Attorney General, went on Fox News to praise his former boss for deciding to take over the District of Columbia's police force, the Fox audience hated it. Why did Fox just bring on traitor Bill Barr? Fumed popular MAGA meme poster Gunter Eagleman. He should be in prison! Just when we thought infighting was the exclusive domain of the left, it turns out there's a conspiracy in MAGA world that Barr schemed with Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis and conservative pundit Armstrong Williams to hatch the Georgia criminal case against Donald Trump and 18 other people. At the heart of the claims against Barr are some reports from undercover right-wing video operation Project Veritas, and the sole source of those claims is Patricia Lelis, a Brazilian national fugitive wanted by the FBI and last known to be hiding out in Mexico. Think of Lelis as being a sort of Brazilian Jacob Wall,
or indeed a Brazilian George Santos, and you won't be far wrong, notwithstanding George Santos comes from Brazil. Lelis alleges that as Armstrong Williams' employee, she became privy to a scheme conceived by Barr to orchestrate Trump's prosecutions, ignoring the fact that Merrick Garland, not Bill Barr, was Attorney General at the time. Lelis says that Barr secretly met with Jack Smith and Fannie Willis to hatch plans to bring a RICO case against Trump and more than a dozen other defendants, which she describes as Barr's enemies list. The list she posted is obviously written by her all loopy handwriting and exercise book, but despite that this is the woman who photoshopped a picture stolen from a Texas family's social media account showing a woman with a newborn slapping her own face on the woman to announce that she had had a baby herself, and that she's been indicted for wire fraud claiming that she duped several clients hoping to secure legal residency in the United States and instead stole nearly $700,000 to spend on her own house down payment, remodeling and a credit card bill claim, Barr has put the entire FBI after this woman to get the documents she has. We've found compelling evidence that appears to corroborate this. And despite that Barr was out of office by the time Lelis started working for Williams and the FBI didn't start investigating her till years after that. Trevian Kuti, the ex-Kanye West publicist who actually was indicted as part of Willis's election fraud investigation, who initially embraced Lelis's claims way back in December 2024 in social media posts, begged Project Veritas in an ex post to realise that Lelis is the biggest scammer on X. And Armstrong Williams' social media team, familiar with the out-and-out lying fraud Lelis is, exhorted Veritas to research her name, like literally type her name into Google. You'd think that living as they do entirely online, MAGA lovers would simply do that. But as we are only too well aware, MAGA are not the kinds of people to let facts get in the way of a good story. Stand by for Lelis to feature in an upcoming documentary-shaped film by Dinesh D'Souza. We at Fallacious Towers can't wait.
In one of the least surprising examples of the cruelty is the point from the Trump administration, last week the Office of Personnel Management issued a memo announcing that all federal employee health plans will be prohibited from covering gender-affirming care for both transgender youth and adults. This ultimately affects health benefits for more than 10 million federal workers and their family members, making it one of the largest rollbacks of transgender healthcare access in US history. The only surprising thing about this is why it's taken them this long, given what fucking monsters they are. And the reason for that is the June ruling by the US Supreme Court in United States versus Scrimeti, which dismissed the argument that banning gender-affirming care is sex discrimination because the Tennessee law in question, in that case, was simply discriminating against anyone of any sex who was experiencing gender dysphoria. Thanks to that bullshit, the administration has decided it's open season on gender-affirming care. I wish that was as bad as it gets, but the memo also mandates that, quote, counselling services for possible or diagnosed gender dysphoria must still be covered. Covered counselling services must be provided by a licensed mental health provider and may include those who provide faith-based counselling. That's conversion therapy they're talking about there.
The new rule is
that federal employee health plans must cover the cost of conversion therapy, a practice that is at least partially banned in 23 states due to the fact that it is actively harmful and increases the likelihood of suicide attempts by LGBTQ plus youth who are subjected to it by 2.5 times. As Mark noted a few weeks ago, it's getting harder and harder to end these headline segments with anything other than just the word cunts.
The Trump administration sent a letter to the Smithsonian Institution on Tuesday requesting a comprehensive internal review of 8 of its museums. This initiative aims to ensure alignment with the president's directive to celebrate American exceptionalism, remove divisive or partisan narratives, and restore confidence in our shared cultural institutions. Trump's March executive order, Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, directly criticized the Smithsonian for coming under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology and for promoting narratives that portray American and Western values as inherently harmful and oppressive. In the Orwellian Trump fiction novel made fact world, of course, this is all doublespeak. The Smithsonian has had an exhibition detailing the history of US presidents and, of course, includes information about Trump's 2 impeachments. One senses that Trump doesn't like that and as head of the Ministry of Truth, he gets to decide what truth is. However, Lisa Strong, a professor of art at Georgetown University, noted museums cannot change content to suit a political whim or agenda. The best way for museums to maintain the high public trust they already enjoy is by remaining independent. Museums are staffed by experts in their fields who interpret the collection to help educate the public about art, history, science, and culture. Their content should not be reviewed, revised, or edited for political gain. And the Smithsonian said it's committed to ensuring that it remains free from political or partisan influence. The Board of Regents will continue its vigilant, independent oversight of the Smithsonian and its museums to protect their rigorous scholarship and expertise, non-partisanship, and accuracy, and ensure that the Smithsonian is welcoming to all Americans. Of course, the White House letter sets out a detailed list of materials that the museum needs to submit for White House appraisal, including grant-related documentation, inventories of permanent holdings, and visitor surveys. And if NPR's experience is anything to go by, Trump has no interest whatsoever in independence or acting without fear or favour. He is all about fear and favour, and will cut funding just to suppress the stuff he doesn't like. But in 2028, when he's out of office, we'll look forward to the exhibition that adds Trump's administration to the long list of fascist regimes that toppled, partly because of the leader's vanity, but ultimately because of their inevitable mortality.
Bold of you to assume that he'll be out of office in 2028.
Well, I'm just anyway, hoping he'll die.
Yeah, well, there's that, yeah. Trump has found a replacement for Erica McIntyre, for the head of the Bureau of Labour Statistics, who he fired after she reported some labour statistics that made him look bad. The new guy is the Heritage Foundation's chief economist and Project 2025 contributor E.J. Antoni. As a frequent contributor to Fox News, Newsmax and Steve Bannon's War Room podcast, who was also at the Capitol on January 6th, Antoni is uniquely qualified for the job, but only because the job Trump wants him to do does not involve producing accurate reports or impartially analysing data. Harvard economist Jason Furman says, E.J. Antoni is completely unqualified to be BLS commissioner. He's an extreme partisan and does not have any relevant experience. But Furman was the chair of Obama's Council of Economic Advisers, so that's exactly the kind of thing you'd expect him to say. Let's find out what some conservative economists think. Stan Vuger, senior fellow at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, told Axios that Antoni's work at Heritage has frequently included elementary errors or nonsensical choices that all bias his findings in the same partisan direction.
Wow.
Kyle Pomelo, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, tweeted, "There are a lot of competent conservative economists that could do this job. EJ is not one of them." And Kyle's American Enterprise Institute colleague, Dave Hebert, said, "I've been on several programs with him at this point and have been impressed by two things: his inability to understand basic economics and the speed with which he's gone MAGA. From selectively presenting data from particularly convenient dates to misrepresenting axes to exaggerate magnitudes, he has used all the tricks in the book and shown time and time again that he is not a credible source of information." In the interests of fairness, I should point out that while Antoni can be seen on video among the Trump supporters at the Capitol on January 6th, an hour after the police barricades were breached, he claims that he was merely a bystander who was in DC that day for totally non-Trump related work meetings, and he wandered over to the Capitol when he heard something was going on. He probably has an equally convincing explanation for the large multi-panel artwork of Nazi battleship the Bismarck that has pride of place in his office.
Jesus. Union Jack and the Cross of St. George flags have been appearing strung up on lampposts around the English towns and cities hosting frightened and fleeing refugees. Is this in celebration of the England women's football team winning the European Championships? No, of course not. It's millionaires Nigel Farage and Kemi Badenoch mobilising the racist, ignorant lumpen proletariat to do their job for them, distancing the populace from the Tory party's previously deliberately throttling of the asylum claim processing service in order to create this crisis so that they can tell the angry mob they are the only ones to solve the problem, and not Labour. Pisspot dictator Nigel Farage of Reform UK Limited is never one to miss a grift, and is monetizing, legitimizing, and fomenting racism because his eye is on number 10, secure in the knowledge that if you can create enough red mist to descend in front of the gammon voters, they'll forget all about how we all got duped by Boris Johnson mobilizing disenfranchised northern voters to support Brexit. The very people that the Tory party disenfranchised through restricting funding to their city councils in order to shift blame onto the European Parliament rather than the Tory government. In sole pursuit of Boris, thereby fulfilling his self-serving, selfish desire to be king of the world. It all worked out so very well last time, folks. I'm sure they're not doing that this time. Meanwhile, to the soundtrack of The Who's Won't Get Fooled Again, one enterprising youth has been taking down the flags and reselling them on eBay back to the patriots who hang them up on lampposts, and then he's been taking them down and doing it again. Othering-based capitalism working across the class divide. Levelling Up Minister and Boris co-conspirator Michael Pob Gove would be proud.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used a fallacy ourselves, let us know. If you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or simply tell one other person in person about how much they like our podcast. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump. Just like our strawman level patron, Chuck Gray, Mike Smith, LT, Colleen Laila, Richard Thunder Hopkins, Will M. Scott, Mike Reiki, and Amber R. Buchanan, who told us when we met her at QED, we could just call her Amber. And last year at QED, I met the listener who recognised her QED the year before, because we kept using her full name all the time. And our true Scotsman level patrons, Renee Zed, Melissa Sitek, Stephen Bickle, Janet Uetta, Andrew Houck, and our top patron, Kaz Tui. Thank you so much for your continued support, everybody. It's really very, very much appreciated. Thank you.
You can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump or in the Discord at fallacioustrump.com/discord.
All music is by The Outburst and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.